assurance that all will be well. Actually, several years ago, and I now remember, we were in India on a pilgrimage, and I passed out. And Alex took care of me. Little did you know when you got involved with this community that this is what you'd end up doing. A little out of your specialty, but... So for those of you, this is your first time tonight, please know that usually we people are not carried out of here. Actually, what just occurred, it was a good example of how we want in this life, where we do not know what will happen next. And as we know in life, anything can happen and often does. And things often or very often do not proceed the way we thought they would, or according to our expectations, right? And what happened just now, it was a good example of that, right? And I want to say the way people responded, I think, was a good example of how something unexpected happens, and rather than panicking, right, or making a drama out of it, as we are often doing. It was just, I felt that people, in a very calm but caring way, just went over there, saw what was happening. All of a sudden, there was a little shift in who was there, and people who had expertise, competency, experience in dealing with something like that came over. Other people were around to offer support. And in a caring, careful way, the situation was taken care of, wasn't it? And that's a good example, I think, in reflecting on it right now, for how we want to be able to lead our life. In other words, we want to come from a place of groundedness, a place of presence, with the capacity to be mindful and responsive, not responsive as people often are, which is we are responsive to our projections, we are responsive to our emotionality, right? And we are often not responsive to the situation or the person as it is unfolding. Right? We are often more responsive to our own reactions. And one of the things in this practice that we want to develop is to get out of that self-created drama and be able to enter life just as it is, so we can deal with situations just as they are. And when you enter situations that way, you're able to respond we could say, appropriately. What does appropriate mean? It means we're responding to the needs of the situation as they are. Not as we think they are, not as we hope they are, not as that we're afraid they are. Do you see what I'm saying? But you're just able to deal with it as it is. And so, I mean, even though Andrew hadn't planned this tonight, it gave us an opportunity, and as I say, to just see that even something as dramatic as this, and again, not that there aren't things that happen in life that aren't many more dramatic, but again, you know, it could be dealt with as what? As simply what it was. And what was it? It was just an unfolding of life. And again, sometimes life unfolds in ways that produce happiness and well-being and goodness and all kinds of things. And sometimes life can proceed with some kind of difficulty or pain or unexpected. The response does not have to be all that different from the place we're coming from, I guess I would say. I mean, does anybody want to ask any questions about that or comment on that? Because it's really important. And I think what happened tonight was good for us to be part of. It's not the end of the world, is it? What just happened to Andrew. And yet oftentimes we respond to even things not as dramatic as that as if it's the end of the world. Great fear, emotionality, hurt, loss, when really all that's happening is things are just changing. And they're changing in ways that we did not expect. But actually, if we were honest with ourselves, very few of us have really powers of clairvoyance, right? Very few of us have powers of prophecy. Right? And so most of us cannot really, with any certainty, say we know how life's going to unfold today, tomorrow, or as happened tonight, even within the next few minutes. To know that might scare some people, people who are ungrounded, people who do not feel safe and comfortable and secure in themselves, in their minds, in life, aren't comfortable with living with that awareness that so much is unknown and so much is unpredictable, right? And so therefore, not feeling comfortable in that truth, we have to give a certain kind of solidity to our expectations about life, which then reify with a kind of rigidity which only creates the need to control and manipulate. Because we do not feel comfortable and safe and sure with life unfolding just as it is. We want it to unfold the way we want it to unfold. And that takes what? A hell of a lot of work. If anybody's ever gone down that path. So not only does it take a hell of a lot of work and vigilance and always being on top of things and always, you know, just controlling from the time you get up to the time you go to bed, but it also means that in life there's a lot of frustration and irritation and disappointment and hurt and angst and fear and, you know, all that stuff. Because even with our best attempts at control and manipulation, life still unfolds the way it unfolds. And so therefore, when our attempts, if our attempts at control and manipulation haven't ruined things already, and things keep proceeding as they will, then we get into all kinds of emotional dramas again. And unfortunately, that kind of way of dealing with life that seems so normal to people is nothing but suffering. causes us suffering. We are never happy. We are never at ease. As well as we cause suffering to those around us. Right? And because, you know, when you're on the side of knowing that somebody is trying to control or manipulate you to get their way or to have you be a certain way, or someone has all kinds of expectations about how they want you to be, and right? How does that feel? That's a happy relationship that you feel comfortable in? Yes or no? No. So that's how crazy we are, because when we're on the receiving side of things, we know how that is not a happy way to create relationship. And yet, when we're on the other side, we think that's the only way to do it. So we resent somebody doing it to us, but we want full freedom to do it to others. This kind of manipulation, this kind of lifestyle, is when we lead a life based on self, on ego, on projection, on stories, on drama. It is through the practice of meditation and through the practice of learning to see things more clearly with some wisdom, some understanding, some intelligence in the best sense of the word, that we can learn to live life and have relationships and deal with everyday lives and ups and downs in, again, a much more open, freer, accepting, intelligent, compassionate way. Which then the possibility of real happiness and real joy and real goodness in life and relationship becomes not only possible but doable. But it takes a retraining for many of us. And many of us don't even know we're doing it. We think this is normal. Right. But as you know, the Buddha began with looking deeply into life. And his first observation was that how so many of these patterns we have are really just patterns that cause suffering. And so it is really by us looking deeply into the way we act and react and relate and interrelate and really ask ourselves those meaningful questions of, you know, is what I'm doing creating the basis for happiness and well-being within myself, within my relationships, or not? Right? We have to kind of come home in a very real way and ask ourselves those kinds of questions. And then if the answer is no, I'm actually not creating happiness, well-being, etc., for myself and others, then we have to begin to look and see why, what that is, so we can make a meaningful change. And as we learn to observe life more deeply within ourselves and learn a better way to live, a better way to relate, a better way to be, not only do we have that power of creating that type of change within ourselves, for ourselves and for others that we're close with, we now have some basis for going into life, into society, coming from a place where we actually have some real experience at creating real value in society. Not just as a theory, not just as a political stance, not just as a social stance or educational stance, but something that's come from our own experience. And so we begin to have deeper understanding, not only about our own personal transformation, but about what it's really going to take to transform this world. Which, as you see, if you look around this world, you see what? People are very, very busy trying to bring peace and justice, right? And goodness into this world. And yet, efforts seem to, many of them don't work, many of them only work for a short time, and we never ask ourselves, why is that? Well, maybe it's just, maybe the way we go about things. Maybe the world and societies and governments and groups go about things the same way that individuals do. Anyhow, some thoughts about Andrew's great demonstration for us. Any just questions about just what I've shared? Anybody not agree or have a question? Yes.
How did you feel in your role as a teacher when this event unfolded? And you were...
You mean how did I personally? Well, I looked over, I didn't know what was happening, but I kind of observed what was happening, and I realized someone had passed out. And but I was very happy when I saw that that Alex, who was a doctor, was right there next to him, and his wife was there, and some other people seemed to be coming around that knew what they were doing. I'm not a medical professional, so I was quite content to just stay at the side. I was concerned about him, but I was happy that he was being well taken care of. That made me feel good.
How did you feel as head of this community when this event happened in the midst of the community?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't sit up here with any sense of myself as head of a community. I don't have any thoughts like that. I was just here as a human being who cared about him, and so I wasn't... I didn't have any sense of role, if that's what you're asking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, all those kinds of things like identifications and role often get in the way of us. You know, in Zen, there's a saying, we already have one head. Why do we add more heads? I already have one head. Why do I need to add a head? You know, I have Fred's head. Why do I need the head of a... head of a community, or we don't need this stuff. Actually, we want to get rid of our heads, so we can see. In Buddhism, there's a saying, a koan, which is, what was your original face? What was your face before your parents were born? It's a very interesting thing. It means, it really asks, who am I? Before I was head of the community, before I was a teacher, before I was the name Fred, before I was taught this, who and what was I really? You know, turning to the essence. And so again, we want to learn to live from the essence of things. Yeah. Good. Any other questions? Yes.
I have a question of different nature.
Yes.
I'm curious, in attempting to seek refuge in the rituals,
in
the Buddha, the Dharma, mm-hmm. and the Sangha, mm-hmm. I find one of those really difficult, and it's the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, what your experience is, like, how do you, on a very personal level, how do you seek refuge in the Buddha, such as, like, prayer, like, ask for guidance,
mm-hmm.
and... Part two of the question is, what are your results, your actual experiences with that?
Well, that's a kind of a big question. Maybe I'll just answer it briefly, and another time we can go more into it, but there's something I wanted to cover tonight. Okay. Well, what is your name again?
Brian,
that's right. So what Brian's question is about, for those who aren't familiar with kind of more traditional Buddhism, sort of the kind of the foundation for people who are following the Buddha's way, not really as a religion, but as a way of awakening, a way of transformation. Going back to the time of the Buddha, people take, when they formally enter the Buddha's path, become a student of the Buddha, they take what are called the three refuges. And this goes back to the Buddha, actually. When the Buddha was alive and he was, for 49 years, he wandered about northern India teaching. He just taught freely, going from village to village, town to town, gathered many disciples, and as time went on, people wanted to become his students, many people. And so they said, how can we kind of, as human beings, we often you know, we like little ceremonies and rituals, you know, like graduation ceremonies or wedding ceremonies or, you know, different kinds of things, ceremonies, birthdays, ways to observe transitions or changes. And so they said, you know, how do I, you know, how do we become a follower of the Buddha? And he said, the first thing is you take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So that's what Brian's referring to. And that's still true to today. So he's asking sort of, what does that mean? And then more specifically, how does one do it to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, especially the Buddha? So let me just quickly say, the Buddha refers to really two things. One is there's the historical Buddha, who we could say is the founder of this tradition, Shakyamuni Buddha, born Siddhartha. Most of you, I think, know his story. But it was really, you know, that which we call the way of the Buddha began with his enlightenment, you know, his own personal experience of awakening that came through meditation, his own deep, deep, profound experience of insight that let him really understand the nature of what this life's really about and who and what he was, and mind and thought and past and future, all became very clear to him, not through reading, not through study, but through directly having a meditative experience of insight. Right? And so his enlightenment is from his, what he came to understand is what he taught. And his capacity to teach in a wise and thoughtful and compassionate way came from his own mind. And what was the nature of that mind? It was an enlightened mind. It was an awakened mind. So to take refuge in the Buddha, on the one hand, is an historical state. It's to take refuge in that historical lineage that has been transmitted from teacher to student, from the Buddha to his disciples, who then became teachers to their disciples right through the current day. So there is this living transmission, right, of the Buddha that one takes refuge in. As well as I said earlier, Buddha just refers to somebody who's awakened to their Buddha mind. So in that sense, in Buddhism, everybody has the potential to be a Buddha because everybody has this pure mind. The only difference between us, we could say, and Buddhas is Buddha has awakened to it. So he's called Buddha. It means he's somebody who has an awakened mind. So the refuge in Buddha is also to take refuge in that Buddha mind, which means, Brian, your own Buddha mind, which really means to take refuge in your own capacity to awake, to transform. That right? No matter where you are, what you've done, or you know how neurotic you think you are, or how disturbed you think you are, you know, in other words, all the things we think we are, that in truth there is a pure, undefiled wisdom mind that is fully functioning now, and we just have to awaken to it. So when one takes refuge in the Buddha, one takes refuge in the historical lineage of teacher Buddha, as well as in the Buddha mind. And then the Buddha, and then the second refuge, which is the Dharma, really has to do with that whole body of teaching and practice, meditation practice, that the Buddha and the teachers teach, you know. We could say this, that's why this talk I'm giving tonight is called a Dharma talk, right? I'm teaching Dharma, which is, you know, the Buddha's teachings, right? And then Sangha is that community of practitioners, the people who practice. Right? So when we take refuge, Brian, it sort of means, so there's life. There's ordinary life. And in ordinary life, there's all kinds of lifestyles, all kinds of philosophies, all kinds of religions, all kinds of ideas, right, about how to live. In the same way, we could say Buddhism is like that. It has a philosophy and a psychology, and, right, a way of looking at life, about what's meaningful and purposeful. As well, it has, a series of teachings and meditative practices are the types of practices that one learns to trust. Because in this world of so many competing philosophies, religions, non-religions, anti-religions, religions that say we have the truth and I have the truth and you have the truth, or just materialistic culture, right? Money, fame, glory, you know, all that stuff. This is the truth. This is the way to happiness. Get more things, get more money, get more status, get more fame. So there's so many things that, you know, that tell us how to be happy. To take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha means that, you know, not exclusively, this is not a cult, right? It means that to this body of wisdom, this body of experience, this body of practice, of teaching, that has been transmitted unsullied from teacher to student, student to teacher for 2,500 years, still exists today, right? When I am looking for guidance in this life, before I have truly awakened to my own true nature, right, and can really are able to guide myself, right, that I take refuge in the Buddha, in this lineage, in this teaching, in these practices. And I look to the support of the community of practicers, not that I give up all my friends, turn my back on my family, not like that, but that this is, the community of practitioners is a special community because not all our friends and family nurture within us this desire to transform, this desire to lead an awakened life. You know, we may have good parents, we may have good siblings, we may have good friends, but not all of them support us on a path of altruism in life, right? On a path of really creating value. Not because they're bad people, but because they might not even know it themselves. So this community of people who are attempting to live this way, right, we take refuge with them. Another way of looking at refuge has to do with trust. You know, who am I going to trust in this life? Right? Especially in this day and age when everybody tells you they have the truth. Right? And, you know, you go to Barnes & Noble and you go to their self-help section, and, right, I mean, everybody's, right? And every year there's a whole new book of self-help books and this and that. Everybody's got the truth, telling us what the truth is. How to, you know, how do you know who to trust? It's a good question. For me, if you're asking me, I'd say, when I discovered Buddhism back, 40 years ago, one of the things that that helped me to trust it was that it was something that has existed within the human culture for over 2,500 years. Right? And that generation after generation, over historical periods, sociological periods, all testify from their own personal experience that the teachings and the practices do facilitate meaningful transformation and awakening, a cessation, a remediation of personal suffering. And from my study of Buddhism and the teachers and the masters in Japan and China and Korea and, Tibet, it was like, oh, all saying the same thing. So from a scientific point of view, there's some validity there. If some experience can be replicated over and over and over again, men, women, historical periods, cultural, ethnic groups, that to me has a lot of validity for at least beginning. So in that sense, for me, it was, I thought this was worthy of my investigation and some degree of trust. But real trust, real confidence only comes over time, when one has one's own personal experience, right? And again, this is nothing unusual, right? I mean, most of us, whether it's school or learning some sort of profession or craft or musical instrument, we are all beginners at some point, right? And when we are beginners, we need to trust our mentors, right? That somebody has more experience than us, and they have competence, right, in their capacity to transmit to us their learning experience. So in the beginning, especially when we're beginners, we have to put a lot of faith and trust in our teachers and mentors. But over time, as we develop skill and competence, right, and experience, the trust is now more grounded within ourselves, based on our own experience. Does that answer your question?
Not really. Oh, okay. I mean, because I have the trust, the kind of faith, I guess, is just mm-hmm. that one part of it that, I mean, it answers it on a conceptual level, but it's mm-hmm. like, I mean, I'm looking for, I guess, a functional, like in Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about actually, like a monk told me about how he was missing out, he thought he could do it all himself, and mm-hmm. he was missing out, and he found that he could, like some kind of prayer, I don't remember what it was he said exactly, but there was more of like a direct link. Mm-hmm. To Buddha or to mm-hmm. any enlightened beings?
Again, different Buddhist traditions do it differently. Like you say, in the Tibetan tradition, there's a great emphasis on devotion and ritual as the way to make that connection. Other traditions do it a little differently. For me, it's always been very personal. So even when I read the story of the Buddha and the life of the Buddha and the experiences of the Buddha, I don't read them as 2,500-year-old stories. Right? I read them very personally, as if these are the experiences of a man. And when I read about his life, I read about his life as a very personal unfolding. So I feel connected to it. Right? And when I read the lives of the teachers and the masters and their teachings, I read it as if these are human beings just like me, sharing their experience, not just ideas. So it's a living thing. I think a lot of it is how much connection you're willing to give it. You know. So again, I think feeling that connection to the lineage, to the teachers, to the masters, right, to the enlightened beings who have trod this path for 2,500 years, and as you read their life stories and teachings, to see it as a living thing, not just stories, and relate it to yourself. What does this mean to me? To me, whenever I read a Buddhist teaching, the question I always ask myself is, all right, now what does this mean to me? Then it becomes real. What does this say to me? What does this mean to my life? If this is true, if this person's experience is true, then what does that say about my life and how I live it and how I practice it? And I think that's meaningful in any way, in any approach you have. You know, if we just, you know, some people read spiritual books like they read novels. You know, they just keep turning the pages, as if somehow this is turning the pages and reading the words gets us anywhere. My sense, when if you're reading something of meaning, You read a paragraph, you read a sentence, and you stop. You know, what is this, what, first of all, what is this person saying? Right? Do I understand what they're saying? Right? And can I touch the mind, the person that is saying it? And then, what does this mean to me and my life? You know, because most books, quote-unquote spiritual books, you know, they're dealing with weighty matters. Am I right? And we need to give weight to them. We can't just be flipping through them, you know, like we're speed reading. Right? And many of us read that way. So, like, I'm, you know, on to the next chapter. It's like people, you know, there's some people who don't chew their food. It's not easy to digest things if you don't chew it. So spiritual teachings have to be digested. They can only be digested if they're chewed on. And they can be only chewed on if you stop and reflect. What does this really mean? What do I understand? How do I understand this? And how am I going to practice this in my life? If I took this teaching into my life, how would I practice it? So when you ask those kinds of questions, the teachings become very alive to you. We're not just consuming. See, we are great consumers. Anybody notice that? We consume things. And we think we can go about the spiritual stuff in the same consuming way. We'll just, you know, read more and more books. I don't, you know, I mean, the only thing I can say about that first book is I read it. Am I able to practice everything in it? Well, no. But I'm already down at Barnes & Noble getting their next book. I really love their first book. I really want to get their second book. You know? Can you see how silly that is? I mean, hopefully people who are writing these books and giving these teachings are doing it to facilitate and aid our transformation. I mean, that's what practice is about, transformation, healing transformation. If we're just, you know, increasing our spiritual vocabulary, that's not very helpful. So we need to digest. Traditionally, in the meditative traditions, the role of teacher is essential. We are very fortunate still at this time, at this age. The teachings are still alive. They're accessible. There are many living good examples of the teachings, people who have come to realization of the teachings. And so when we meet individuals who have two eyes, a nose, a mouth, two legs, two arms, we see them going to the bathroom, we see them eat, we get a sense that they are human beings just like us. And so when we encounter human beings like that, who in their lives, not just their writings, but in their lives, demonstrate this sort of awakened way of living, right? That's also a very important connection to Buddha. It helps grow confidence that it's realizable. I mean, the whole idea of taking refuge is not to, build up the Buddhist franchise in this world and to get more converts. The whole reason to take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma Sangha is to energize and stabilize our own transformation. That's all. You know, nobody's working on commission here. It's important to understand that. These practices are meant to help us. Why? Because we are fickle. We have little fickle minds, and they flit all over the place. And we're into this week, and next week we're into that, and we're following this one and that one. Take a little from this, and we take a little from that, and then we forget all about it, and do something else, and then we remember it, and right? That's kind of how we go about this most important thing of healing and transformation. And waking up, I mean, we make it into a kind of a third-rate hobby rather than something that is really dealing with really the most meaningful thing of our life, which is what? Our minds. How many people here exercise regularly? How many people don't exercise regularly, but they know they probably should, because it's good for you? Wow. How many people here do their best to eat healthily? How many people who don't eat healthily know that they probably should eat? Wow. All right, by going, how many people here get a good night's sleep, 7-8 hours sleep? How many people who don't know they probably should, that it's good? You see what I'm saying? Smoking, right? I mean, we can go on and on and on, right? So we know so many things that we can do in this life to what? To take care of our body. Right? A lot of wisdom, a lot of understanding, and we will spend a good part of our day, right? Preparing foods, cooking, taking our supplements, our vitamins, exercising, going to gym, jogging, walking, right? Right? Making sure we get to bed, doing all kinds of stuff. Making sure we don't put toxins in our body. How much energy and awareness do we have with our minds? Do we devote even more time to taking care of our minds? Because, I mean, the mind is the basis of who and what we are. When you're happy, where are you happy? When you're sad, where are you sad? When you're angry, where are you angry? When you're joyous, where are you joyous? When you're anxious, worried, You know, all, it's all going on where? In our minds. Right? And yet, you know, we don't have even a vocabulary until very recently of how to have a healthy mind, of how to take care of our mind every day. I mean, most of us know every day it's probably a good idea to what? To bathe it. I mean, simple things like that. You know, bathe our bodies. Probably a good thing to do. How many of us know how to bathe our mind, to clean our minds? And we laugh because we don't have a clue. No one ever taught us about cleaning our minds. How do I keep my mind healthy? How do I keep my mind buoyant? How do I keep my mind energetic? We don't have a clue. And yet, that is the most essential. So if you ask me, you know what these traditions are about, such as Buddhism, among others, it's about this. It's a tradition that teaches us how to care for this mind of ours. And the parts of our mind that have gotten sick, gotten diseased, gotten wounded, gotten broken, gotten sullied, it teaches us how to heal them. But even more than that, with enlightenment, with the Buddha's own experience, it really demonstrates for us that there is in each of us a wondrous capacity to have a mind that is liberated from all suffering, all the emotional afflictions that we think are so normal, that we accept as just part of life. And from the point of view of the enlightened mind, so much of what we, so much passes for in this life is unhealthy, is sick, is diseased, is narrow, is constricted, it's petty. And yet many of us live in that very petty, constricted, narrow life, which we could call what? The life of self, the life of ego, the life of egocentricity, the life of me, only me. And so we need to make sure that we don't turn Buddhism or turn these kind of teachings into something that feels higher than or more than or, you know, than ordinary life and ordinary human beings. These teachings and practices speak directly to our human condition. And if they are meaningful, they should speak directly to our capacity to change. Yes?
Last week in Naples, you talked about really finding a baseline for well-being. Could you just, in regard to what you're talking about now, just comment on that?
I think actually, didn't we talk about that a couple of weeks ago too? Or maybe I do different groups, so I forget. But what Angie's referring to is, I had mentioned, and then somebody asked me for an elaboration. What I said is that, unfortunately, in our culture, we don't have a baseline, a sense of what it is to have a healthy mind. Right? And I use the analogy that most people, unless they've been sick all their life, physically sick now, have a physical baseline of what it feels like to be healthy. Right? So I would imagine mostly everybody in here, when you wake up one day and you say you're coming down with something, right? Or you say you're getting sick, or you're saying you're sick, you're saying it in reference to a sense within your body of what it feels like when you're healthy. Is that clear? You say, you can't say you're sick unless you know you're healthy. If you've always been sick, you think that's normal, you think that's healthy. But most of us have had some sense of a healthy body that we can tell when we're leaving it. And we can also tell when we're returning to it, right? So if we have been sick, we all have the experience of saying, oh, I'm feeling more like my normal self, right? I'm getting healthier. Or in the same way, when we talked about food or exercise or good sleep, we know that when we're not getting good sleep and we're eating junk food and when we're not exercising and we're couch potatoes and all that stuff, we what? How do we feel? We don't feel good, right? But then when we get back into shape and get exercise and all that, we say what? Oh, I'm feeling healthy again. I'm feeling good again. Now, that's all because we have a baseline of health, physical well-being that we can relate to. And what I'm suggesting, that we do not have a baseline for our minds. So that's why we can go all over the place in our mind states and think that's normal. And what I'm suggesting to you, and you can all experience this through meditation, but even without meditation, if your mind has ever been at ease, if your mind has ever been open and spacious, if your mind has ever been within that happy, you know, and maybe you've had that experience a lot in life, maybe you have that experience when you're in nature and you go to the beach, or, you know what I mean? I don't know, or you hear music, or, you know, you're with your baby. I mean, I don't know how it comes, but you have that sense of completeness, wholeness, openness, ease of mind, right, when you're in that state. That is normal. And I say that to you. That is normal. That's the baseline. And that's why we practice through our meditative practice and through learning to stop doing things that continually take us in the wrong directions, right? I mean, if we want to be healthy, we have to learn to stop eating unhealthy food. Right? I mean, there's certain things we got to stop doing because we know when we do them, they cause our bodies to suffer. So in the same way, we need to stop doing all kinds of mental activities and emotional activities that just cause suffering, constriction to our minds, to our emotions. And at the same time, we learn to need to cultivate, you know, a whole different set of emotions and meditative stances. Again, this is you don't have to be a fully enlightened Buddha to experience this. It's not that difficult. But it does take some practice. It takes some consistency. It takes some dedication. In the same way, you know, if you're 200 pounds overweight and you live on Doritos and you spend 8 hours a day watching television, right? You know, you're not going to wake up feeling healthy the next day. There's a learning curve. There's a transition. There's time that's got to be put in. But anybody who's willing to put in this time can begin to reestablish a different baseline. And when you have your baseline, see, if you don't have your baseline, you're always trying to get there. But if you have a baseline, you know, just like when you're healthy, you know when you're getting sick. And you know, oftentimes we know we're getting sick and we do something, right? I need to get more sleep. I need to drink more water. I need to stop doing this. I need to take some of that. I mean, you know, we can, there are often things that we can do to prevent it from getting worse. Right? Or if we're just out of sorts and we're stressed, we know I gotta get more sleep, I gotta start exercising again, and all of a sudden what? We feel better. So in the same way, once you have that baseline and you leave it, so if an open, at ease, calm mind is your baseline, when it starts constricting, when it starts gets a little bit of emotionality, when it starts getting negative, you feel it. And you know you're leaving your true mind, your natural mind, and you just do something. It's not a big deal. But if you're not there, it is a big, it's hard to get to it. Right? So that's what I'm talking about. We need, in the same way that we have a sense of our body as healthy and unhealthy, feeling good, not feeling good, healthy, sick, right? It's something we know. We need to develop over time that same mental sense of what my mind feels like when it's healthy. See, we don't even have a concept of mental health. Right? In America, we have a concept of pathology. We are very good at listing all the pathological mind states of the mind. And the idea is if you don't have them, well, then you're healthy. But what does that mean? Just because you're not a couch potato, just because you're not, you don't eat Doritos three times a day, does not mean you're healthy, does it? No, there are things you need to be doing. In the same way, to have a healthy mind, there are things we need to be doing. And we need to do it with the same, if not more, commitment and dedication. People work out a lot these days. Have you noticed that? People put a lot of energy into working out and having and taking care of their bodies, and put a lot of energies into shopping right and eating right, and right? Cooking and blah, 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 and taking their supplements. What if we put that much energy into our minds? Which I think in the long run is probably much more central to human happiness. I'm all for having healthy bodies, but I know lots of people who have very healthy bodies who are not very healthy mentally. Unfortunately, that is not a path to happy mind. What time are we supposed to stop?
It's about 25.
Yeah, so maybe we should stop.